Bill is an Australian academic historian, adjunct professor and senior research fellow at the Humanities Research Centre of the Australian National University. He's a fellow of the Australian Academy of Social Sciences and deputy chair of the National Museum of Australia. He's best known for his book, The Broken Years, Australian Soldiers in the Great War. It was first published in 1974 and reprinted many times and was the source for Peter Weir's film, Gallipoli. The study revives the tradition of C.E.W. Bean, Australia's official historian of World War I, who focused his narrative on the men in the line rather than the strategies of generals. So different histories. At last we're getting some different histories. Bill corresponded with 272 Great War veterans and consulted the personal records of another 728, mostly at the Australian War Memorial. In 1998, Bill joined the Humanities Research Centre at the ANU as a senior research fellow for the Australian Research Council, working on the history of Aboriginal land management. His scope was cross-disciplinary, working across fields as disparate as history, anthropology and botany. In the subsequent 13-year period, he researched and wrote the book The Biggest Estate on Earth, How Aborigines Made Australia. So that's the one that we'll be focusing on tonight, I guess. And there are copies up the back if you wish. It was released in October of 2011. It won the 2012 Prime Minister's Prize for Australian History in the Prime Minister's Literary Awards, and as well as a lot of other awards. Like his previous work on the First World War, this book promises to reshape Australia's understanding of our history. Perhaps in the future, Bill will be best known for this work. Rather than being just historical, Bill's work provides insights on how we will learn to truly live in Australia, rather than acting like we've just gotten here and on a camping holiday. It's for this reason that we invited Bill here tonight. So please welcome Bill Gammon.
Thanks very much, Sue. I wonder where you got all that from. I'll say. In a way, I'm sorry you said so much so kindly, because I can only live down to it. I can't live up to it. I'm very pleased to be here, and I'm very glad to see so many people here. I'm reminded of what happened to Derek Randall, the English opening batsman. Could we leave that on so I can read the... was at the Sydney Cricket Ground in 1974, and he was the first drop in, and he came out and he was a fiddler, and an affable sort of a fiddler, and he spent a long time adjusting his gloves and so on, and while he did it he was smiling at the people around him, and one of the people closest was Rod Marsh, who didn't smile at Englishmen. But he kept smiling and kept smiling, and finally he was ready, and Geoff Thompson was bowling, and Geoff Thompson bowled in first ball. And as he walked back to the dressing room, a notice came up from the crowd and it said, "Thanks for coming." So thanks for coming. When I talk, I'm going to use the phrase 1788. And that's just a shorthand for that moving frontier of settlement which began at Sydney Cove in 1788 and went through the continent for the next 140-odd years. So just accept that as a shorthand, please. In their responses to light and space and fire, plants record their history. And eucalypts store more history than most. Their shape shows whether they grew in the forest or in the open. Locally, their size sourced them by generation. And each generation's shape, size and distribution announces the vegetation history of its surrounds, whether this was once dense or open forest, or first one and then the other. Seeing trees in that way, seeing them by generation, can show dramatic changes, particularly where grass or woodland later became forest. In a way, they allow you to read the history of the land around and therefore to build up a picture of the locality's 1788 and colonial past. On the screen is a photo of a swamp gum taken southwest of Scottsdale in Tasmania. And most of us on the mainland, on the North Island, know swamp gum as mountain ash. So this is mountain ash. And again, most of us know mountain ash as dense forest of tall, straight trees. Fire rages, the forest dies, and the rich ash, thousands of seedlings race up to get light, and the tall forest returns. I hardly need to tell people here about that. But this mountain ash has spread because it's always stood in the open. How? A bushfire would kill it and replace it with swathes of competing seedlings, whereas without fire, this is rainforest land, as possibly you can see in the background there. Only centuries of controlled fire could burn back that rainforest without ever touching this fire-sensitive tree. Now, this is one example that you can see today of where what we might call a natural plant cycle has been interrupted. You can see the same thing in standalone Karri in Western Australia, and also where eucalypts are capturing ancient grassland, and under their cover, rainforest is encroaching, which means that without fire, those places grow rainforest, and you can see such places from Tasmania all along Australia's east coast. Only determined and repeated fire could have made places like that grass in 1788, I presume sometimes by mere metres at a time. Those fires are no more, and so rainforest returns. Colonial words and paintings and survey plans depicting land tell the same story. Many of them show what was grassland in 1788 is now eucalypt forest. And the obvious question to ask is, why only now? Why not then? Some researchers say that bushfire converted pre-1788 forest to grass, but after a bushfire, scrub comes back more, not less, and anyway, bushfire rarely clears off big eucalypts. They resprout from the trunk and their limbs, and they soon recover their dominance. Only repeated fire, clearing the seedlings and saplings for centuries until the old trees die out, converts eucalypts to grass, and only people make fires like that. Forest regeneration is so evident now because people favoured grass in 1788. Grassland carried many useful plants and most animals with most meat. It was a firebreak, it made seeing and travelling easier, and it confined forest, making forest resources more predictable. Almost always it took the best soil. Probably there was more grass then than now, and if there was an imbalance in Aboriginal plant distribution, it was a slight extension of grassland into forest or scrub. That is, small encroachments by fire, marginally out of control, and also the exact opposite of what is happening today. In short, for over 220 years, the land has been shouting at us newcomers that we've got it wrong. The country was not natural, but made. Aborigines made it by using fire or no fire to distribute plants, and that plant distribution to locate animals. Giving plants and animals ideal conditions made them abundant. Carefully distributing their habitats made them convenient and predictable. This was possible because most Australian plants tolerate fire, and because in Australia almost uniquely, the only large predators to disturb prey were people, and so there was a point in concentrating animals. Most of us now accept what Rhys Jones neatly called fire stick farming, that is, patch burning grass to bring on fresh growth to lure grazing animals. A few early newcomers noted this. At Albany in Western Australia, George Vancouver observed in 1791, fire is frequently resorted to by rude nations, either for the purpose of encouraging a sweeter growth of herbage in their hunting grounds, or as tools for taking the wild animals of which they are in pursuit. In northwest Tasmania, Henry Hellyer remarked in 1828, it's possible that the natives, by burning only one set of plains, are enabled to keep the kangaroos more concentrated for their use, and I can in no way account for their burning only in this place unless it is to serve them as a hunting place. Aborigines themselves stated at Evans Bay in 1849, observing that the grass had been burnt on portions of the flats, the blacks said that the rain that was coming on would make the young grass spring up, and that would bring down the kangaroos, and the blacks would spear them from the scrub. Evans Bay is next to Torres Strait. In other words, it's as far from Albany and Tasmania as you can get in Australia, and yet all three peoples manage land similarly. Evans Bay is also next to islanders who gardened, so people could compare their management with Torres Strait agriculture. But if they did try gardening, they abandoned it. It's possible they tried it because there are exotic plant species which could be food on Cape York, but the people certainly were not imitating Torres Strait agriculture at the time Europeans arrived. Instead, they matched the rest of the continent, choosing a course that they thought more efficient and reliable. In 1845, Ludwig Leichhardt called this choice a systematic management of their country. The choice made large-scale gardening impossible because people allied with fire. About 70% of Australia's plant species tolerate or encourage fire, and that's a key fact about Australia. Trees and bushes reseed or resprout, while dominant fodder grasses are perennial, so unlike Europe's fodder annuals, they reshoot. In other words, they refuel. 1788's first fire task was to control fuel, by ceremony of course, and by constant careful burning. This let people prevent the terrible killer fires which have immolated the fringes of every Australian capital except significantly Darwin in recent decades. Those fires must have decimated people in 1788 had they occurred. It was not possible to outrun such fires. But regular fires prevented irregular fires, and instead of this slogan of my youth, prevent bushfires, which was nailed up on every big tree, the rule was a fire a day keeps bushfires away. Taming fire was a great achievement. It's one we haven't managed. It was also caused to manage every corner of the continent. There was no wilderness, no terra nullius in 1788. That was something Europeans brought. Edwin Eyre observed in 1841, no part of the country is so utterly worthless as not to have attractions sufficient occasionally to tempt the wandering savage into its recesses. The very regions which in the eyes of the European are most barren and worthless are to the native the most valuable and productive. And so to every place the fire stick came. Of course, people burnt the most useful land most, and sterile or sensitive land, perhaps not for generations, but sooner or later they burnt everywhere. Quote, in every part of the country, though the most inaccessible and rocky, John White observed in April 1788. on the highest mountains and in places the most remote and desolate, in every place, Thomas Mitchell wrote in November 1836. If fuel built up, it was burnt. And that unleashed rich possibilities. I'll go through a series of steps from controlling fuel, which lead you, I think, inexorably to managing country. One, the more fuel is reduced, the more easily is fire controlled, and so the more useful it is. Two, even hot fires leave unburned patches, but the cooler the fire, the bigger the patches, so you can regulate that. Three, patches benefit animals by joining burnt to unburnt country, that's feed to shelter country, burnt feed, unburnt shelter country. Four, patches form mosaics, which can be adjusted in size by the varying fire intensity. And five, intensity can be regulated by fire frequency and fire timing. Six, frequency and timing are local. They depend on local flora and local moderators like rain and wind and temperature and aspect and so on. Seven, the better people understand these variables, the more they can burn with purpose. They can move from limiting fuel to shaping the country. And eight, this lets them selectively locate fire-tolerant and fire-sensitive plants, situate mosaics and therefore resources conveniently and predictably, and arrange them so that one supplies what another does not. Now, local variations in managing fire are many and obvious. You can never burn rainforests in the same way as Spinifex, and in the north you can rarely burn during the wet, whereas in the south there are opportunities year-round. But despite that, everywhere the basic purposes of fire were the same: to limit fuel, to ensure diversity and abundance, to regulate plant and animal populations. The plant patterns that people made with fire were the same too. You put grass on good soil, split forest by grass, tree and scrub clumps in grassland, and you make undergrowth uncommon. And the benefits were the same. Plants and animals were located where they could flourish and where they were predictable and convenient. I'd just like to remind you that so carefully was fire managed and so great its impact that we might easily miss its obvious corollary, which is no fire. A conscious decision not to burn also regulates plants and animals, obviously. People judged equally what to burn and what not, when, how often, and how hot. So fire and no fire worked together. Now, this is not simply fire stick farming. To my dismay, some readers think my book merely elaborates fire stick farming. They mistake my case and they diminish the beauty and complexity of what people were doing in 1788. When you think about it, fire stick farming is an end point. It's a harvesting. It's activating grass or reed patches, but it's doing it on land that had been made grassland long before by very different fire regimes. Proof of its limits lies in how much 1788 fire didn't suit it. For example, people made some grassland to keep animals off, and so they never patch burn it for fresh growth. Yam daisy, tuber, a stable, grows amid the same rich grass which best lures grazing animals, and kangaroos love it, yet it flourished in, quote, millions in 1788. Fire also thinned or distributed forest and scrub which might never be patch burnt, while along forest edges people might let grass grow and dry, and then in the right wind fire it hot to drive prey to waiting hunters. This is Joseph Lycett, Aborigines using fire to hunt kangaroos, painted about 1820. You can see there that there's dense forest on the low ground and it's rising up to grassy hills. You can see also that fires are driving grey kangaroos, some of them disadvantaged by the slope, up to people who are waiting with their spears. In other words, the hunters are not chancing on game. They're not the wandering savages of our myths. They're predicting when and where that game will come. They're also protecting the forest. They're firing its lee edge so that the flames will take into the grass. If the wind lay the other way, they could fire that edge. You can see somebody else doing the same thing over here. In other words, skillful burning is keeping the forest dense, the grass clear, the game convenient. Look at that sharp edge. Only fire could do something like that. Near Brisbane, John Matthews saw the reverse technique. There he said, hunters fire the grass in a line from one projecting point of the scrub to another and force the game away to a corner formed by the scrub margin so that the game, obliged to seek shelter in the scrub, became easy marks for the persons posted along its edge. That's what you do if the forest is very dense. You in effect reverse that technique. People also backburnt around clumps or single trees to protect them, as they still do in the north, and they sheet burnt to clean country. In the centre, in June 1876, Ernest Giles reported, "The few native inhabitants of these regions occasionally burn every portion of their territories, and on a favourably windy day, a spinifex fire might run on for scores of miles. We occasionally cross such desolated places where every species of vegetation has been by flames devoured." That's a clean-up fire. Big fires scour the centre today, carbonising the topsoil, but 1788's big fires were controlled. Giles continued, "Devoured they are, but not demolished, as out of the roots and ashes of their former natures, phoenix-like, they rise again." All scientists would write like that today, and historians. Fire-sensitive plant communities evidence other fire regimes that are not forestic farming. Today you can see rainforest remnants in sheltered inland gorges like Palm Valley and Kings Canyon, and they seem curious anomalies, green oases ringed by aridity. But their survival shows that for generations people took care to regulate how many fires, or more exactly how few, broke into them. Again, early travellers cursed dense forests. In fact, in 1788, people laced such forests with paths and clearings, but in any case, many plants and animals prefer it, and so it's a habitat. The value of dense eucalypt forests was strikingly demonstrated in January 1798, when the First Fleet emancipist and initiated man, John Wilson, led an expedition from Sydney southwest through Bargo Brush, an area soon to become notorious for its poor soil and stringy bark, much the same thing, and its tangles of fallen scrub and timber. In one memorable week, that party noted the first koala, the first lyrebird, the first gangang cockatoo, and the first mainland wombat recorded by a European. The gangang was new to Wilson, but he knew the wombat and the koala, giving their Aboriginal names, probably their Blue Mountain names, Wombat and Kalawan, from which no doubt koala derives, if you pronounce it. He knew the lyrebird, but he called it a pheasant, which perhaps is why today it has no familiar Aboriginal name. The point is that no one in the settlement thirsty to discover or keen to make a quid had reported these creatures. Their country was bad, formidable, seeming untouched. Wilson knew them because Aborigines valued them and made or left habitats for their benefit. Where a purpose is apparent, I call planned communities deliberately associated long-term templates. Dense forest or swamp margins were as much templates as grass forest association for fire stick farming. But no matter which plans communities dominated locally, similar templates for similar purposes recurred across Australia. From Spinifex to rainforest, from Tasmania to the Kimberleys, people associated food plans and shelter plans. By selecting optimum conditions on templates and not nearby, they made target plants and animals on them abundant, convenient and predictable. They then activated the templates in plan rotation according to season and circumstance. Thus, they knew where their resources would be, when to move them and when to harvest them. They could choose. They depended not on chance, but on policy. Lycett's painting depicts a template. Here's another one. This is Eugen or Eugene von Gerard, the crater of Mount Eccles, southwest Victoria, obviously. Now you can stand where von Gerard stood and you can recognise this scene. That's a that's a car park now. There's a walking trail around here. These rocks are visible, although these are under dense scrub. You can see this rock face here. You can see that keyhole in the lake. This rock face here. But notice that vegetation and then look at this. There's the car park, the keyhole, rock face to rock face. In here is those rocks I showed you. There are tall trees, which I'll switch back to, as you can see here, in von Gerard's painting. They're the tallest now, but the scrub is obviously regenerated. But look at the difference in that scrub. You see how it's spread quite erratically over the landscape. Look at it in von Gerard's time. Those tree lanes, when you go and look at the country, these tree lanes here, when you look at the country, there's no soil or rock or aspect explanation for such things, and indeed if there were, then the trees couldn't be as they are today. They're made, and essentially they're made to trap wallabies. What you do is you create these tree lanes both in and out of the crater up here. Then you burn a patch in the grass. Wait in ambush. The green growth from the patch attracts the kangaroos, and you then ambush them and spear them from the scrub. If they go upslope, which is not very likely for kangaroos, they'll stay in the grassland, by the way. But if they go upslope, they're going to hit the rock face and people waiting. If they go downslope, which is their instinct, they're going to hit the water and they're even more disadvantaged. This is James J. Cobbin, a survey plan south of Cowie Point in Cape York on the 24th of January 1891. I'm sorry this is playing up because I wanted to point out things. But basically, green is rainforest and that, white is open forest. Cobbin had to certify, quote, on honour, that his plan was accurate, and yet every vegetation type is on every terrain. You can see here rainforest, or vine scrub as it was called then, and it's sheltering camps where people camp along the beach. You can see its main locality from their hunting grounds further inland. You can see the rainforest, vine scrub, is growing along the creeks, but not always, and indeed in this part, on the lower ground, where you expect rainforest to grow most easily, it's clear, open eucalypt country, whereas on the higher ground, there's rainforest. Similarly here, there's an unnatural break. You can see it doesn't follow contours between the rainforest and the cleared ground. And look at this here. This is a swamp. Obviously, it's going to be even around all its margins, and yet half of the swamp is in rainforest and half of it is in open ground. Now, what I've done is simply emphasise with colour what Cobbon drew on honour as natural. And you can see some of Cobbon's basic survey marks here. What he and others thought of that was that this would be good cropland, usually for tobacco. But without repeated fire, this land becomes rainforest, and that's what it is now. Have a look on Google Earth and you see that's all dense rainforest. Jerry Gill just gave me a survey of this area, one of Robert Hoddle's survey, and here again is marked on it places that are timber, dense timber, and next to it level plains clear of timber. The same style of thing. Of course you'd have to go and see whether there are natural explanations such as soil types to check whether or not that's a consequence of Aboriginal fire. And sometimes that's the case, but many times, as here, Aboriginal burning explains such unnatural patterns. Two factors blended to make templates, one of them ecological, the other religious. Ecologically, laying out country variably to suit and balance all other species meant undeviating commitment to very intricate land management. Individual and inclination and enterprise must be curbed, and ecological rules and knowledge must reach beyond living generations. The law, which I interpret as a religious philosophy rooted in ecology, compelled that. Across Australia, it taught that every living thing has at least one totem derived from a creator ancestor, otherwise it can't exist. Even life forms that Europeans introduced, camels, houseflies, rabbits, they have a totem. And every totem has people who belong to it and at the risk of their souls must care for it. Emu people must care for emus and emu habitat, and emus and emu habitat must care for them. And so on. Rules and myths and ceremonies about the sanctity of totems, including fire, warned and instructed until the consequences of disobeying were too terrible to contemplate. Totems thus protected diversity and enforced conformity via religious sanction, the most powerful possible in every society, isn't it? Evidence for this intricate fusion of law and ecology exists in enough dispersed places to say that the whole continent was a single estate. The people went further. They made land beautiful. After bush, a word that the First Fleet brought from South Africa, the most common word that newcomers used to describe the landscape was park. It's a striking word. Europe's parks were made. They deliberately associated water, grass and trees in picturesque array. Few were public in 1788, in fact as far as I can tell only two or three, and they were fenced. Most parks were the preserve and mark of gentry. They signified wealth and leisure, and yet newcomers from those very places frequently compared Australia with them. In Port Jackson on the 26th of January 1788, Arthur Bowes Smythe rejoiced at the beautiful and novel appearance of the different coves and islands as we sailed up. The finest terraces, lawns and grottos with distinct plantations of the tallest and most stately trees I ever saw in any nobleman's grounds in England cannot excel in beauty those which nature now presented to our view. In November 1826, Robert Dawson thought the country inland from Port Stephens in New South Wales truly beautiful. It was thinly studded with single trees as if planted for ornament. It's impossible, therefore, to pass through such a country without being perpetually reminded of a gentleman's park and grounds. The first idea is that of an inhabited and improved country combined with the pleasurable associations of a civilised society. You may have seen on the television about two or three weeks ago now, the fires raging through thick generation scrub around Port Stephens. So very different from that description. In Tasmania, John Hudspeth praised the beautiful and rich valley of Jericho, more like a gentleman's park in England, laid out with taste, than land in its natural state. W.H. Lee thought the country south of Adelaide a wild but beautiful park, which reminded one of the domain of an English noble. And Alexander Buchanan considered the west side of the Murray below the Big Bend really most beautiful, like a gentleman's park all the way, fine plains and thinly studded with trees. That's Mallee country. You try and find that sort of layout in Mallee today. And there are hundreds of similar remarks. Yet, even when they saw parks, most newcomers still thought the land was natural, as those quotes show. They assume that primitive hunter-gatherers lacked the skill and inclination to make parks. Yet, a clue was there in that observation that fire made fresh grass to lure kangaroos. That lure works. You can see it on golf greens today where kangaroos will get onto the greens and prefer to risk flying golf balls and angry greenkeepers to get at the grass on the green, even though there's safer but longer grass just a metre or so away. So let's explore this lure with grey or forester kangaroos such as Lysett depicted. To attract them with fire, obviously you've got to ensure that they go where you've burned. So you must make sure the grass you burn is the sweetest and most nutritious available. Take care not to burn other grass too close and provide shelter nearby so that the kangaroos won't feel vulnerable while they're feeding. To ensure that the grass you burn is the sweetest and most nutritious available, you must put it on the best soil. But trees grow on such soil, so you must burn to keep it permanently clear of trees, or at least most trees. Yet, kangaroos shelter among trees, so you must provide them neither too open, so that the roos feel exposed, nor too dense, so they fear being slowed down. So beside the grass, you must have open forest, and perhaps beyond it, dense forest, to shepherd the roos back towards the grass. In other words, you must make not only the grass, which is what firestick farming talks about, but the land around, using at least three distinct fire regimes and probably more. Now, there's no point doing all this just in one place, because after you hunt kangaroos, they move. You must lure them to the next place you've prepared, then the next, and the next, and so on. In other words, you must pattern the whole country into places which will and won't shepherd grey kangaroos if you want to farm them successfully. Now think of all the other marsupials, red kangaroos, wallabies, potoroos, bedongs. Of course, not all in the same place, but each with their distinctive habitat preferences. And then think of all the other plants, animals, birds, reptiles and insects which flourished when Europeans arrived. All had their place, or they wouldn't have been here. All had food and shelter which suited them. Many are now gone or going. To accommodate such diversity, you've got to set up a great variety of templates. Of course, some species find a home in more than one template, possums, for example, as we know, but others don't. Spinifex and mulga, rainforest and blady grass, such as here, eucalypts and tussock grass with bulbs and tubers, mangroves, reeds and other water plants, all of those have to be laid out. And given how long some trees in particular live, this might take centuries to set up. Templates for the same purpose could be close, but when activated, had to be far enough apart not to disrupt each other, as obviously that would make the target animals unpredictable and the whole system pointless. Activating a template thus meant negotiating with neighbours and totem elders. The law prescribed a lot of that, but still negotiation must have been constant, so the template system could hardly have had land boundaries. If you've got to negotiate with your neighbours, there couldn't be a place where it was practised and next to it a place where it wasn't. A place where neighbours negotiated continuously next to a place where they behaved randomly. In that sense too, Australia was inexorably a single estate. That system was much more than merely sustainable. Sustainable is a word Europeans have adopted, isn't it? It always reminds me of a swimmer with his nose just above water, you know, sustaining life, battling like that. That's not the Aboriginal way. Possibly even in hard times, their system was so abundant that people may normally have harvested only resources made surplus by expanding off their templates. In other words, as numbers bred up, some animals would move off the template and they would be the ones that Aboriginal people would harvest. Such abundance was possible because people had plenty of land, so they could let plants and animals recover on those templates undisturbed. Mobility was thus a great advantage. Whereas farming licensed population growth, mobility curbed it. Whereas farming drove people out of marginal land, mobility let them prosper there. People did not have to stay by their crops, and no livestock, no beast of burden anchored them. Donald Thompson noted that Arnhem Land clans spent several months mobile and several months sedentary each year, but each period was equally planned and predictable. Was, he said, a regular and orderly annual cycle carried out systematically and with a rhythm parallel to and in step with the seasonal changes. The nomadic movements of these people can be forecast with accuracy and their camps foretold with reasonable certainty. Phyllis Carberry thought mobility, abundance and predictability let Kimberley women work less hard than farmers' wives and yet get food more certainly. She said, it's not the steady, strenuous labour of the German peasant woman bending from dawn to dusk over her fields, hoeing, weeding, sowing and reaping. The Aboriginal woman has greater freedom of movement and more variety. The agriculturalist may be left destitute and almost starving if the crops fail or are destroyed by drought, flood, fire, locusts or grasshoppers, as sometimes happens in China and in Europe. I never saw an Aboriginal woman come in empty-handed, though in 1935 there was a drought. She concluded, women's work compares favourably with a European 8-hour day. Geoffrey Blaney pointed out that people work many fewer hours a day to secure food and shelter than farmers anywhere. Perhaps neither author counted fire or ritual as work, but only people untroubled about food could have held so many ceremonies. Of course, there were hungry times, or people may not have managed their resources so carefully, but it was not the norm. People were not hinging on uncertainty or toil. On the contrary, they could afford to host hundreds of guests, sometimes for months. This required setting aside big stretches of country for years ahead to build up food, and yet such occasions were common. Abundant resources are also attested by how much spare time people had. Europeans often complained, and some still complain, that Aborigines were lazy, that they sat around for hours talking and dancing or singing, even in broad daylight. Today, Many outsiders think the most distinctive features of Aboriginal society relate to art or corroboree, in other words, to what Europeans think leisure. In fact, much of this is work. It's planning or performing to keep country and future alive. But only a well-ordered society could afford so much time away from the food quest. Really, the best parallel for Aboriginal society in 1788 is Europe's gentry. So it's not surprising that newcomers thought the land so often like a park. The parks have gone. Stopping fire, let trees grow. Near Harndorf in the Adelaide Hills in midsummer 1839, Dirk Hahn saw people burning in the Onkaparinga Valley. They form a circle about 20 English miles in diameter, light fires around this area, and then direct the fire closer and closer in towards the centre of this circle. That's quite a trick. The long dry grass, bushes and young trees burn fiercely. All the animals living in this area flee towards the centre, where the savages then capture them. The fire burned for some days. I had never before seen such a fire. In the same valley, though, Hahn saw the result of such a fire. Beautifully formed trees, which nature had planted there as if for the hands of a gardener. Every tree stood about 40 feet apart from the others. Some were perhaps an acre apart, so that the land could be cultivated without uprooting a single tree. I found grass 3 feet, 4 inches high, I presume a metre high. They look like our European cornfields. Here's that same valley 30 years later. This is William Rodolph Thomas, an Aboriginal family group on the Onkaparinga River near Harndorf in 1870. You can see the scattered big trees that Hahn admired, and like that Mount Mash in the first picture, their spread confirms that they grew in the open. But there are no cornfields now, no grass, only scrub. This ruin is what many think southern Australia was like when Europeans arrived. And the reason for that is because this is when closer settlement begins, and so most of our memories and stories commence. The southeast colonies passed their key closer settlement acts in the late 1860s, so this 1870 scene conveys what selectors faced. No parks by then, but decades of backbreaking axe work. And of course, 100 axes are not nearly as convenient as one controlled fire. This is Frederick McCubbin, Down on His Luck, painted in 1889. I chose it because not a especially good illustration of my point, but because I hope it suggests that you can walk into any art gallery of colonial Australian paintings, have a look at the paintings and see for yourselves evidence of Aboriginal land practices in them. In this you can see regenerating sea oak and wattle capturing grassland, gums and bottle here, shea oak along here, all regen from its size. Only one tree there is older than about 1840 when newcomers occupied this district. That's that big stringy bark, and its trunk is partly blackened from fire, although I'm not sure you can see that so clearly in this brightness, but there's couple of blackened spots on the trunk. So, this was once woodland because there's so few big trees. Now, or very shortly, because of that regeneration, the axe must work. The pioneer legend rightly honours the hardy men and women who carved homes from the dense bush, but that dense bush is not how most land was in 1788. To conclude, to locate and rest resources, the template system needed big areas free of people, while allying with fire required a mobile population with few fixed assets. A scant and scattered population made 1788 Australia vulnerable to invasion, but this should not mask how impressive the Aboriginal achievement was. To balance land and people so richly for so long across so great an area ranks among humanity's great achievements. No other world civilization managed it. Almost all turned from hunter-gathering to agriculture, and thence in time to a bad end or an uncertain future. Aborigines never joined the agrarian world's race to a complex technology. There are instances of farming in 1788, plenty of them, but people were never likely to convert to it. Fire gave too many advantages. It let people fuse the ecology and religion of an entire continent into the biggest estate on earth, and instead of dividing Aborigines into gentry and peasantry, it made them a free people. Thank you.
So just before we go on to question time, I'd like you all to stand up and take a little stretch, just where you are. Take in some very deep breaths and reach right up. And breathe out. Fast. Get some oxygen in and out. Two more times. Out. Last one. Okay, so take a seat again now, and Bill is quite happy, I understand, to take some questions. Yes?
Yeah, sure.
Is that being done in accordance with the old tradition?
See?
Yes.
Even in the north, people don't know as much as the old people did in 1788. It's inevitable that a lot has been lost. But in the north and in the centre, they know more than anybody else. And as much to the point, they're going to stay on country, and so they're going to accumulate learning and pass it on through the generations. And what you're describing is an example of that. Even though their knowledge is imperfect, they know more than the pastoral stations, and I think you're referring to things like Fish River, where Aboriginal people have contracted to manage the country in a traditional way, for the pastoral station. They're doing the same thing for some mining companies. Yeah. So they've got more to learn, but they're so far ahead of us, it's not a joke.
What are your thoughts?
Not coming from Victoria, I can speak without fear. I think it's very good that the acreages are being increased. There are many more trees and much more regeneration now than there was in 1788, and therefore it's axiomatic that we're in a much more dangerous fuel situation than we were then. As the 2009 fires show, Aboriginal people didn't suffer a fire like that, otherwise there would have been a huge gap in their genealogy, and there is not. I think the problem is that the tendency is to sheep burn, in other words, to burn large areas, to meet a quota of hectares. And that is dangerous for protecting species. Sheep burning just destroys habitats. So I think control burns have to learn to be more skillful, to identify what Aboriginal people would call special places, what we might call conservation areas, where you burn protectively, probably back burning, or change the burning timing or intensity to protect particular species, plant, animal, bird, reptile, whatever it may be. So we're on the road compared with what used to be the case, but we're only just starting. Species protection is the big challenge for controlled burns, I think.
Bill, in your book you talk about the moisture underfoot as you walk through the rain in 1788. Could you expand on that and the reason that that happened because of the burning regime?
I don't recall which part of the book that's in. Could you?
It was just a general feeling when I read the book about it. As you walked on the ground, you were putting the moisture in the ground.
I don't think that was inevitably so. I imagine that possibly you might be referring to my description of the native grasses. And they ripen in late summer. In other words, their growth period is over the summer. And that has a couple of effects. Firstly, there's green feed for animals during the hottest and therefore the what we now know as the most dangerous time of the year. And secondly, those grasses shield the ground and therefore retain moisture much more than the perennials like wild oats, which you can see around here, which dies off at about this time of the year or even earlier and therefore exposes the ground and dries it out. I think that...
No.
That was it?
Yes.
Good.
Do you think that, from what I've been reading, it sounds like the waterways, which were, you know, chain of ponds and these beautiful wetlands and billabongs, and probably the nature of the water table being higher before we drained it so much, do you think that that meant also had, and in relation to your comment really, that sort of additional moisture in the creek lines and in the earth generally, it seems that would have also helped contain the fire.
It's certainly the case that all or almost all the rivers and watercourses flowed more shallow in 1788 than they do now. They've cut into their beds. It's sort of counter-suggestive to say that because the first consequence of clearing is to increase earth runoff, which makes rivers and so on shallower, and they fill in. But as that continues, the very speeded up flow, which caused that soil deposition in the stream beds in the first place, then cuts in to the stream beds and they go much shallower. And what that means is that where water once spread quite readily into swamps or billabongs or even onto the flats, it now does so much less often. In the country I come from, which is the Murrumbidgee country, Wiradjuri country, a lot of the creeks there were distributaries. In other words, they flowed out from the river. Now they've changed because the river has dropped. They've changed and they're now tributaries. They flow into the river. It's a dramatic illustration of how things have changed. But there are plenty of places that were very dry anyway. You know, there was more water, but there's plenty of dry places as well. Yes, they have. I've got a lot of respect for firefighters on the ground. People who have actually fought a fire learn a lot very quickly. And while I sometimes not complimentary of senior fire policy people, as I say, I've got a lot of time for fires people on the ground. And there are rural fire service units which are entirely Aboriginal. There's one on the Lachlan in New South Wales, and there are units which are part Aboriginal, part not, and there are discussions. So I know of one in Bega in New South Wales, for example, where the problem of fire had brought firefighters and Aboriginal communities together for the first time to discuss what they see as a common problem. I hope there'll be much more of it. I hope to see Aboriginal people in policy positions actually making these decisions, but we're on the road. On the road. Ah, yes. Yeah, it's a striking thing, isn't it, that soft earth. In Victoria, I hope you'd all know about the Major's Line. That is the dray tracks that Mitchell's drays trace from southwest Victoria to the Murray. And squatters like Hepburn followed those dray tracks, and they were still clear a decade after. Now, where is soil soft enough to do that today? You go up into the alpine country, up into the mountains, and perhaps near trees you can push your finger in. There are a few places, but it's not common at all. Yeah, so even the soil has compacted since 1788. That might have been it. Was the,
Did you find the Aboriginal kids there burning in the autumn? So that, like, they worked at, you know, drop a match or fire stick, and then, like, the winter rains or late autumn rains to help put it out.
They burnt all the year round. They burnt most in summer. And probably least in spring, because that's when birds are nesting and snakes are breeding and so on. Exactly, and they did burn in autumn, especially on poorer country. Sydney sandstone was most commonly burned in autumn. But exactly when they burnt, as I said, depended on the season and the circumstance. The season... Some seasons are hotter than others, some wetter and so on. The circumstances might be they're building up food for a ceremony, and so they would burn differently for that purpose. They might burn a kangaroo grass flat every 3 years in normal times, but then the totem man for grass wrens comes up and says, the grass wrens have had a bad year. That totem man in charge of the snakes hasn't kept them under control, and so we have to give the grass wren more breathing space, and therefore that flat wouldn't be burned. That would disadvantage the kangaroo grass, it would go back a bit, but still they would do it. And that's what I meant about neighbours negotiating continually. Those circumstances varied all over the place. So what we can derive is general awarenesses, and I think the most key is that they could burn in summer, whereas it's a big risk for us today. If they could burn in summer, their control over fuel was quite dramatic. So we can learn at that level, but not all those intricate variations in totems and so on. We're not talking about a system that you can learn off in a couple of days. This is a very complicated system. They spent whole lifetimes on it. We've got to expect to do the same.
You end your book by talking about becoming Australian and the, learning how the land actually works. I mean, but if you stopped without any sort of half an appendix about science, any actual indication of what sort of basic land policies might help.
Yeah.
Just wondering,
you
go on with that.
Well, I'm a historian, not an economist. You want people to talk about the future, you ask an economist. They'll wave their wand and so.
But like land use around here is becoming very important for all sorts of modern points of view.
Well, I think you know, all history warns the future. So I think there's enough in the book to tell people, you know, that there are messages about the future in it. Fire, species protection, Aboriginal expertise, the changes in water flow, the increase in salinity, the compaction of the soil, all those things are things that people themselves can say, right, oh, well, what are we going to do about this? What I'm basically saying is, don't think it's always been like this. It's been something that we've made, something that we've destroyed, and therefore it's possible to do something about it. As I was just saying, it is possible to burn in summer, in midsummer, if you know how to do it. It seems to me I don't need to say, therefore in future we should try and burn in summer. Any mug can say, right, well, we should try and burn in summer. And that's true of virtually everything else in the book. Yeah. But I must say, most of the questions that I get everywhere are about the future. So I think that shows that you can extrapolate from one to the other. You don't need me. Mm.
Oh, I was going to say that I have gone out into your book and I've read a huge respect for what the Aboriginal people did in managing the land. And what they did was they saw themselves as part of nature. And we see ourselves like we're in control and must do this or do that, or have a policy about that. If we could only sort of start thinking more in terms of working with nature somehow, we might start to look at other ways of doing things.
Mm.
But this is a
first step in the way. Yes. Although I hope you mean that in a sort of hard-headed way. These are people who spend their lives walking around their country and they are learning very practical lessons from their ancestors and from the land. Given that, yeah. I don't think they did it perfectly, mind you. That totem system is really brilliant when it comes to managing an ecology because it makes some group of people responsible for every living thing. Even, I had a friend who I quote in the book whose totem is a maggot. A maggot totem. That's what he calls it. Maggot totem, or called it. It's an illustration that everything has a totem and everything has a responsibility. But it's only people and plants and rocks and so on which have a totem which is not their shape. In the animal kingdom, only kangaroos are kangaroo totem, whereas people can be kangaroo totem. So you can see there's not a perfect parallel between a kangaroo and a person. The person has got a freedom and a responsibility which a kangaroo doesn't have. Of course, a kangaroo is also responsible for men of the totem. The assumption is that they're looking out for kangaroo totem people and their habitat, and you can see it. You know, you can see emus looking after emu country by cleaning it up. Koalas are regenerating fresh eucalypt trees. Clearly, animals have those responsibilities, but you can still see that people are still separated. So the key thing is not so much to think of how close we are to nature, whatever that is, but how we can keep all species going, how we can maintain diversity.
Bill, some people would interpret perhaps from your work that all of the life forms that we've brought here are a large part of that destruction. How do you see that lesson from the past translating into Australia now that has almost doubled the wild plant species, at least in southern Australian parts that it had at settlement, and of course the powerful, large, introduced animals and
Exotic species have added immense complexity. I said that 70% of Australia's species tolerate or encourage fire. That's native species. The percentage is much less now because of introduced annuals, notably our crops, but there are many other things as well. And on the other hand, our resources to deal with a lot of these are increased. I mean, we don't necessarily need to use fire. It's the best, but we could have mowing or bulldozing or things like that, which Aboriginal people clearly couldn't. So the pluses are greater and the challenges are greater and the responses are slightly greater. But it is a problem, there's no doubt about it. But it seems to me we must learn. We must learn. When I said about being an Australian, one illustration of that is that virtually every summer some of our people die from fires on the edge of capital cities. Capital cities, the places with the most resources that Europeans can muster, and yet sometimes hundreds of people die. We can't really say that we're managing our own country while that's going on. We can't really say we're an Australian. So balancing the challenge of gamba grass, for example, that feed flies on heat, against the deaths of citizens every year, I don't think there's much doubt about which way we should be trying to push things.
Seems almost to what you're saying, that it needs the vast areas to manage this fire system. Have we cruelly outpitched, in a sense, by overpopulating the areas?
Is the size of our population too big for managing the country? I think so, yeah. I think we've got too many people here. But they're here, that's a fact. So we have to accept that. We might want to reduce it in the future, but that's what we've got. And there are places where to introduce the fire controls that Aboriginal people have would be, I'd say, politically impossible. Nobody's going to shift out of the Blue Mountains because they've just been burnt. You know, you're going to put houses in places that that can burn. That's something that's got to be accepted. But our population doesn't spread nearly so evenly over Australia as Aboriginal people, and there are many parts, in fact, geographically speaking, virtually all of it, where, if anything, the population is less, especially if you exclude mining areas, population is less than it was in 1788. And there, it seems to me that Aboriginal expertise could make a great difference to managing the country. And as for the cities, well, perhaps we'll have to let them burn.
Perhaps that's a way of that we are controlling our own population by not managing the edges of our
cities. Oh. I say nothing. Yes. Well, that's true, but it's going to happen more. If population grows, it's going to, you know, not in my lifetime, but the time will come when people are building national parks and so on, because that's all the land that's left. Fair enough. Yeah, that's That's a Dorothy Dixer, isn't it? To a history teacher. Yeah. Look, I really think that history, first of all, teaches you span. You are not likely to roll up and think that this land is always as it has been if you've got a historical perspective. You might not grasp how thoroughly Aboriginal people managed it, but you'll be predisposed to think that all things change. That's a maximum of history. And that's a great advantage for the future. History warns too. And I think history gives you judgment. You can see how people behave. You can see how many more people behave than not studying history. You learn from the lessons of the past. You don't know how often, how they're going to apply. That's why I say history warns the future. But at least it shows you the options. But then I'm biased.